allegation that Russia is not against Ukraine joining the EU. The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by foreign ministers of the two countries.
Expect a ceasefire upon these meetings, negotiations, within days, maybe through this week, through the end of this week. But this might be a limited ceasefire. I mean, the Donbas region may be out of ceasefire, but at least there will be a positive step through ceasefire. The peace agreement will take some time. The questions are, problems are very big. Donbas and Crimea are something the leaders needed to discuss and agree.
The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by the foreign ministers of the two countries. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry announced a suspension of all operations around Kiev and Chernihiv after the meeting. Today's meeting was considered constructive, as it will pave the way for deeper negotiations between the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, and hopefully reaching an agreement on a complete ceasefire. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing this affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and the petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. Everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
Rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails. Their show of solidarity comes as around 500 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for almost 3 months. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence, without charge or trial, for long periods of time.
This step by Palestinian administrative detainees is continue for around 86 days, protesting the administrative detention. And they insist to continue this step until they attain their demand of stopping, halting this illegal detention.
Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, as well as elderly prisoners, are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are subjected to torture and psychological pressures by the Israeli prison authorities.
Today we are here to support the prisoners. Prisoners is our hero. We are to support prisoners and their families. We are continue to support them in all ways.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
We are here to support our prisoners. They are facing suffering in Israel J and their family. and to tell Red Cross to defend our prisoners. They are suffering with administrative detention and hunger strike.
Families of the prisoners say they will continue their weekly sit-ins until all Palestinian prisoners are set free.
People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Israel currently incarcerates around 5,000 Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy. Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali represented lo specchio del...
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Andala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On the banks of Kashmir's famous Dal Lake, surrounded by the majestic Zabarwan mountain range, Asia's largest tulip garden opens for visitors. 1.5 million flowers of 68 varieties have vibrantly colored the earth.
This is heaven and this place is beyond imagination. After facing lockdown for 2 years, this place is a treat.
Whatever is said in the media and shown is not the truth. The truth is, it is the most secure place to visit.
Kashmir is witnessing bumper tourist season this spring after COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Administration as well as people expect a bumper tourist season.
We are trying our best, and this year we are lucky in terms of early spring, so that people of Kashmir will have an economic boost.
Following the coronavirus pandemic, the tourists stopped visiting Kashmir, and last 2 years, Kashmir's economy faced a major setback.
Tourism is our backbone of our economy. The money they pump in our economy is manifold for our economy. So that's why our tourist, this tulip garden, it gives impetus to our tourist season. It prepones our tourist season. We have seen the initial response from tourists, particularly from outside UT. We are hoping that this season will be a great season for our tourism sector.
To reclaim the fractured economy, Kashmir's administration has organized a tulip festival to attract more tourists and locals so that the lockdown impact vanishes slowly to conflict-wrecked Kashmir.
After 2.5 years of continued closure due to COVID-19 pandemic, the opening of this garden has brought delight to the people of Kashmir, who for decades have suffered political instability and turmoil. Opening of such spaces help boost morale and is a good start to a fresh year. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic and facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just 1 day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
in the limelight.
In the United States, in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas was involved in a range of efforts to keep President Donald J. Trump in power. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Danny Hakim, Joe Becker, and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, "Texts Show Jenny Thomas's Embrace of Conspiracy Theories." Stay with us for more. Two days after the 2020 presidential election, Virginia Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, texted an old friend, Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of President Donald J. Trump. She sent messages that had been making the rounds on pro-Trump sites, where anger over the election echoed her own raw feelings, including this passage. Biden crime family and ballot fraud co-conspirators, elected officials, bureaucrats, social media censorship mongers, fake stream media reporters, etc., are being arrested and detained for ballot fraud right now and over the coming days, and will be living in barges off Guantanamo to face military tribunals for sedition. Then she added, of this fanciful, if chilling, set of conspiracy theories, I hope this is true. She texted Mark Meadows again the next day. Do not concede, she wrote. It takes time for the army who is gathering for his back. The messages were among a flurry of text traffic between Jenny Thomas and Mark Meadows that was revealed this past week, part of a trove of documents previously turned over to the House Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol. A hardline conservative activist, Jenny Thomas had long been viewed with suspicion by the Republican establishment, yet her influence has risen during the Trump administration, especially after Mark Meadows, who, like Ms. Thomas, has roots in the Tea Party movement, became chief of staff. Now, an examination of her text, woven together with recent revelations of the depth of her efforts to overturn the election, shows how firmly she was embedded in the conspiratorial fringe of right-wing politics, even as that fringe was drawing ever closer to the center of Republican power. The disclosures and urgency to question about how Ms. Thomas may have leveraged her marriage to Justice Thomas, who would be ruling on election cases throughout the battle over the 2020 vote and beyond. As his wife agitated for Donald Trump and his aides to turn aside the election results, Justice Clarence Thomas was Donald Trump's staunchest ally on the Supreme Court and has remained so. This year, in January, he was the only justice who noted a dissent when the court allowed the release of records from the Trump White House relating to the 6th of January attack. Calls intensified this past week for Justice Clarence Thomas to step aside from such cases. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, said on Friday that Justice Thomas needs to recuse himself from any case relating to the 6th of January investigation, and should Donald Trump run again, any case relating to the 2024 presidential election. The Thomases have been a fiercely close couple for decades. In his memoir, Justice Thomas wrote that they were one being, an amalgam, and called her his best friend. She often uses similar language to describe her husband. In one of his texts to Jenny Thomas, Mark Meadows called the election a fight of good versus evil. Meadows added, "Evil always looks like the victor until the King of Kings triumphs. Do not grow weary in well-doing. The fight continues." Thank you, needed that, Jenny Thomas replied. This, plus a conversation with my best friend just now I will try to keep holding on. America is worth it. Jenny Thomas's text to Mark Meadows tap into a deep well of debunked conspiracy theories. References to the rounding up of elected officials, reporters and bureaucrats from military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay are drawn from QAnon, which imagines evil leaders running the country and trafficking children. Yet in the days after the 2020 presidential election, Jenny Thomas had far more standing to take action than most who embrace such canards. As Donald Trump courted Justice Clarence Thomas during his years in office, curious about his popularity among the Republican base and also about rumors that he might retire, aides said the justice's wife won increasing access to the White House. Though some Trump aides came to view her with such suspicion that the assembled opposition research meant to damage her standing with Donald Trump, among other things, she pressed the president to hire people who could not pass background checks. The aide said her clout grew with time. The arc of her political career had also led her to a powerful new platform. Ms. Thomas had started out working for establishment right-leaning organizations like the Heritage Foundation and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But her desire for more radical change had led her to the Tea Party and increasingly to the party's fringes. Mark Meadows, who was appointed chief of staff in March of 2020, held similar views and has attended meetings of Groundswell, a group that Jenny Thomas founded in 2013 after consulting with Steve Bannon, who would later become Donald Trump's chief strategist. With their brand of conservatism ascendant, Jenny Thomas had been appointed in 2019 to the 9-member board of CNP Action, an offshoot of a secretive but influential conservative group called Council for National Policy, whose membership includes leaders of the National Rifle Association, the NRA, the Family Research Council, and the Federalist Society. The New York Times Magazine, in a profile of the Thomases published last month, detailed CNP Action's assertive role in efforts to overturn the presidential election. That included circulating a document to its members in November of 2020, urging them to pressure Republican lawmakers in swing states to challenge the results and appoint alternate slates of electors. Demand that they not abandon their constitutional responsibilities during a time such as this, the document said. In one of her texts, the contents of which were earlier reported by the Washington Post and CBS News, Jenny Thomas sent Mark Meadows a link to a video featuring Steve Pixanik, a former State Department official who was claiming that mail-in ballots had been watermarked as part of an elaborate government sting operation to catch voter fraud. Mr. Pixanik previously appeared on a webcast with the conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and claimed that the 2012 school massacre in Newtown, Connecticut was a false flag operation, a notion that has been thoroughly debunked. On 19th of November, Jenny Thomas promoted the effort of Sidney Powell, the Trump lawyer who spent much of the post-election period spreading conspiracy theories. Sydney and her team are getting inundated with evidence of fraud, Jenny Thomas wrote to Mark Meadows. Make a plan, release the Kraken, and save us from the left taking America down. That same day, Sidney Powell held a news conference with Rudolph Giuliani, one of Donald Trump's lawyers, at the Republican National Committee headquarters in Washington. There, she laid out baseless allegations that a cabal that included Chinese software firms, international shell companies, and the financier George Soros had conspired to hack America's voting machines. At that time, Sidney Powell was in the early stages of preparing 4 federal lawsuits that would present this purported plot as a reason for judges to overturn the election results. She nicknamed her lawsuits the Krakens, referring to a giant octopus-like sea creature. By 10th of December, John Eastman, a former Supreme Court clerk for Justice Thomas and a close friend of the Thomases, went on War Room, a podcast hosted by Steve Bannon. John Eastman urged the Supreme Court to intervene and said the country was in the midst of a constitutional crisis. Behind the scenes, he was advising Donald Trump and his campaign on a proposal regarded as outlandish by many other lawyers, that Vice President Mike Pence could refuse to accept swing state electoral votes and send them back to the state legislatures when he presided over the certification of the election in a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021. John Eastman's role would only become fully clear months later. On 10th of January, Ginny Thomas texted Mark Meadows to express her disgust that Mike Pence had not gone along with efforts to keep Donald Trump in power. "We are living in what feels like the end of America," she wrote. "Most of us are disgusted with the vice president and are in listening mode to see where to fight with our teams. Those who attacked the Capitol are not representative of our great teams of patriots for DJT. Amazing times, the end of liberty." In her speeches and communications with other activists, Ginny Thomas regularly invokes her husband's name. Last summer, she invited Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, a Republican, to speak at a meeting of Groundswell, which she referred to as a cone of silence coalition. In an email to Ron DeSantis's staff, which was obtained through a public records request by the watchdog group American Oversight, she wrote that the justice had been in contact with the governor on various things of late. "We start and end each meeting with prayer, but the left has all the cultural institutions now and seem to be weaponizing them against conservatives and basic freedoms," she said in her email, adding that she was hoping that Ron DeSantis could pick us up and refocus us, as Washington is not where our hopes lie.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli forces have raided a Palestinian village home to a man who has shot several Israelis in Tel Aviv. The forces clashed with residents and arrested members of the man's family. The 26-year-old Palestinian man gunned down five Israelis, including a military officer, in a suburb of Tel Aviv on Tuesday. Resistance groups regard the attack a natural response and a heroic operation retaliation for the crimes committed by the Tel Aviv regime. In recent weeks, more and more Palestinians in different parts of the occupied territories have been targeted by Israeli forces. There have also been several attacks on Palestinians in the Negev by unknown Jewish groups. Now, what's next for Palestinians? What option do they have to deal with the violence and treason of some Arab states?
A natural and legitimate response to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. This is how Palestinian resistance groups praised the deadly shooting spree that left five Israelis dead in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox city of Bnei Barak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, on Tuesday night. The operation was carried out by 27-year-old Diya Hamarshi from Yabat town near Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Hamarshi was shot dead during the clashes. Both resistance groups, Hamas and al-Jihad, in addition to other Palestinian factions, had welcomed the incident.
These operations are part of the Palestinian people's struggle and resistance. We are speaking about an increase of operations and acts against the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. In one way or another, it's related to the fighting status and last year's Sword of Al-Quds battle. But also, there are numerous factors that naturally lead to counter-violence used by Israel. Provocations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the settlement activity, and settlers' aggression, discrimination, and violence against Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948.
Israeli military decided to bolster its troops in the occupied West Bank and border areas with four additional battalions. In addition, two battalions will be sent to reinforce troops in the Gaza Strip envelope area. Israeli forces raided Yabat town and stormed Hamash's home. Large crowds gathered and clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. Hamash's family members were questioned, and at least 30 Palestinians were detained in Yabat and other areas.
Israel is threatening to do what it's already doing, which is oppression of the Palestinian people and continuation of occupation and the apartheid racial system of discrimination. Any more escalation will only complicate the situation more. What should be clear here, especially after the Negev meeting, that nobody can marginalize the Palestinian issue, and that the Palestinian issue is the central issue of this region.
Tuesday's operation marked the third deadly operation in lands occupied in 1948 in Israel in a week, bringing the combined death toll to 11 Israelis, excluding Palestinian perpetrators. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett vowed that Israel will fight what he described as terrorism with an iron fist. Israeli military officials warned that Tel Aviv's shooting and the recent operations in Umm al-Fahm and Bir al-Sabah could lead to copycat attacks. Palestinians, however, reiterate that such incidents are a normal response to Israeli crimes and violence in the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our panelists in today's episode of Spotlight. Richard Becker, anti-war activist with the Answer Coalition, and also the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, out of San Francisco. Also joining us will be Khaled Barakat, journalist and activist in Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight
takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. My first question for Richard. In your opinion, Richard, what's responsible for this rising violence and escalation that we've been witnessing recently in the occupied territories?
Well, you know, the way that the media reports in the United States is that violence only takes place when there are acts of resistance by Palestinians. But every day, the violence is going on against the Palestinian people in the West Bank. Gaza, of course, a giant open-air prison with really declining, steadily declining living standards for the people who live there. But every day, the settlers and the occupation forces in the West Bank carry out acts of brutality and often murder against Palestinians, but that doesn't show up in the media in the United States. And of course, It is the oppression, this long-term oppression and repression of the Palestinian people, which is going to bring about all kinds of resistance, some of it in an organized way by organizations, some of it individual acts. It's impossible to have the situation go on the way that it is now and the way that it has been for many years and many decades and not see all kinds of acts of resistance take place.
Now let me turn to Vancouver. Khaled, the Palestinian assailants and even some who pose no threat, they get gunned down by Israeli forces regularly. But how come their homes come under attack? I mean, why are their family members arrested?
Well, this is a practice that Israel do on a daily basis, and that it's the, you know, collective punishment. When they arrest a Palestinian, they made sure to terrorize the entire neighborhood and the village. And this is a daily life of Palestinians under occupation for the past 74 years. So it's, you know, and we don't want to get used to it. We are going to resist that, the natural thing for Palestinians is to actually resist occupation, resist colonization and apartheid. And, you know, these escalations that they are talking about is happening inside 1948 occupied territories, or what they call Israel, which means that the Israelis are witnessing a also a new phenomena. They cannot have a free hand in oppressing our people inside Israel the same way they do in the West Bank and Gaza. Last May, you know, Israel killed over 500 Palestinians in Gaza with U.S.-made, you know, weapons, and the world was silent. And for Palestinians to resist that, it becomes, you know, a concern by the United States. Actually, the U.S. is responsible on Israel crimes and what Israel is doing, and they're providing not just the military and political supports for them, but as Richard mentioned, they are absolutely fabricating these stories and lies in U.S. media, and that's something also we know why they do that. But absolutely, we are going to witness a rise in the Palestinian resistance, especially in the holy month of Ramadan. And Israel now needs to understand that they cannot keep confiscating Palestinian lands and demolishing their homes and then expect Palestinians to be silenced. The other issue is the political issue in the region. When this, the shame of summit that happened in Naqab, where Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are meeting in Palestine, to declare basically a coalition. That's not normalization. Okay. That's building a coalition.
We'll come to that later in the show. Okay. Now let me go to Richard and ask him this question. Richard, resistance movements regard attacks like the one that we're discussing today as a natural response to the Israeli crimes committed against them. Do you agree?
Well, when you actually witness, and I have just very briefly been able to witness the kind of day-to-day brutality against the population, against the Palestinians, and as Khaled says, inside 48, there is resistance and oppression as well. But when you see the situation, you actually see it. I mean, I think most people who go from the United States, and even if they think they have an understanding of how bad it is, and the apartheid regime, and the police and settler repression, and so forth, no one can really grasp it until you see it. And of course, you can't really grasp it until you live it. But when you see it, it's just shocking, the level of brutality against the Palestinian population at the hands of the Israeli military, and even more so at the hands of the settlers. And the way that the reactions are by the authorities there, like there's just a story in the media from there a few days ago about how a man is assaulted by Israeli settlers, five or six of them. He's beaten, and he fights back, and then he's arrested, and the settlers are let go. This is a day-to-day, I am not exaggerating, when the attacks by the settlers take place, these fascist settlers, and I use the word fascist advisedly, these fascist settlers, they chop down the olive trees, they assault people, they attack their homes, they attack people in cars, and the Israeli military, which is right there, either does nothing or joins with the settlers in the attack. So what do we think the population, how the population is going to respond to that?
Okay, Khaled, in multiple areas in the occupied lands, Palestinians these days feel more insecure, like Palestinians living in the Negev region. They're concerned about, you know, Jewish vigilante groups there. For instance, we have this Battle Rangers unit that's a civilian group launched by a former Israeli police officer who is claiming inadequate police governance in the southern region. So why should Tel Aviv allow such radical elements to threaten Palestinian lives? As an occupier, they're responsible for the security of those people, aren't they?
Absolutely, but Israel do that all the time. I mean, it was established by these militias, Zionist, you know, criminals militias, and they kept, you know, the settlers, they're all armed. So the settlers are actually paramilitary kind of part of the security, part of Israel military presence in Palestine. And so when you see a colony or an Israeli settlement, this is not just, you know, people who are living there. They have, like, weapon storage rooms. They have military compounds. They have weapons. These are not, you know, neighborhoods, as Israel tried to put it, but it's actually a military compound. In fact, when they arrest Palestinians, sometimes they take them to these settlements first as, you know, a station on the road to prison. So Israel does that not just in the West Bank. It also do that in 1948 areas, and particularly in the Naqab, because also they want to oppress Palestinians without having any legal charges or accountability. At the same time, what Israel is doing in the Naqab is being not just the state oppressing the Bedouins and the Arabs, Palestinian Arabs in the Naqab, but it's also institutions like the Jewish National Fund, who is funding these programs, and who is also trying to put a humanitarian face on the so-called development of the Naqab, when in fact what they're doing is confiscating Palestinian land. And the vast majority of this land, by the way, is owned by its original owners, are refugees in Gaza. These are people who were uprooted from their, you know, villages in the Naqab. And the Palestinian people are united today, actually, more than any other time in their history. Yes, maybe there is probably differences between Palestinian political parties. But as far as Palestinian people are concerned, they are united. We have seen this last May when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians across Palestine and in the Shatat, in diaspora, went out in the streets calling for escalating for Palestinian resistance, chanting for Palestinian resistance, and that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea.
Now, Richard, to make matters worse, as Khaled also mentioned a short while ago, recently there was a summit held between Tel Aviv and foreign ministers of Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, and the UAE. You know, they just recently signed that normalization deal, and that drew the ire of Palestinians. So what makes these states stand by Palestinians' enemies?
Well, you know, on one hand, we should be glad to see them actually come out in the open and reveal the reality of the opposition that the Palestinians have faced for so many decades. And that is that they not only are fighting against Zionism and Israel taking over the land and U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, but also the reactionary Arab regimes, and who have pretended to be supporters of the Palestinians, who for a long time gave money in some cases, or other forms of support, in the hopes that that would ensure their reputations against their own population. And the population of all of these countries is not in favor of the Arab countries I'm talking about, who are being drawn into this through the Abraham Accords, as it's called, and so forth. Right. The people aren't in favor of this. The people are against it. The people sympathize with the Palestinians. But the rulers of these extremely undemocratic states, like, you know, the Kingdom of Morocco and United Arab Emirates, where only 11% of the population is allowed to be citizens, or Saudi Arabia, that just beheaded 81 people on the same day on March 12th. These are extremely reactionary governments that are proclaimed in the United States to be our friends and, you know, those who are standing for democracy. Well, they're not standing for democracy, and they're opposed to the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause, because they know how central the Palestinian cause is to the cause of the Arab people throughout the Arab nation and throughout the Arab world. And that this can bring, you know, a victory for the Palestinians would be a victory for all. And so they are very fearful. These governments are very fearful.
Mm-hmm. Khaled, well, you raised the issue, so let me ask you this question. The Arab leaders who signed the so-called normalization deals with Tel Aviv, they believe that a two-state solution should be implemented with the Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem as its capital. Is that the solution?
No, this is not the solution. In fact, they don't even believe it themselves. I mean, regardless of how rotten this so-called two-state solution is, but they don't even believe that. What they're doing now in the region is these Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are forming an alliance under the auspices and the care of the United States and U.S. imperialism. This camp is fighting another camp in the region, because this is just the reality. The region is divided into two camps. One that is pro-Zionism, colonization, these regimes who wants to maintain their power and their authority, and they are undemocratic regimes. They want to maintain their power. And there are another camp in the region, and that is the people's camp, the popular camp, and also a resistance camp. And in this camp, it's Iran, Hezbollah, the Palestinian resistance, the popular movements, the student movements, the anti-normalization movements. And as Richard mentioned, you know, the last polls, even there's by the account of their own, you know, centers, over 80% of Arab youth even reject normalization. So we know that this is a conflict, and it's part of also an international conflict, and we see how this is played. Palestine is in the center of this.
Okay, Richard, let's also hear your opinion on the two-state solution.
Well, the solution is the right of the Palestinian people. What solution there will be is the right of the Palestinian people to determine. You know, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people, but we do not from inside the United States pretend to give advice to the Palestinians on what to do. But I think that it's if you look, just look at a map, and you look at a map of the West Bank, and you see the vast encroachment of settlements. You have to and the complete separation from Gaza. You know that the Israelis don't have any intention of granting anything like that. But how, what would it be on this point? Would it would require the dismantling of the settlements, and then if such a state came into being, which was discussed, the only the conditions that Israel always has insisted upon, fully backed by the United States, is that it would have to be a demilitarized zone, demilitarized state in which Israel continued to control the airspace and the water resources and the borders. In other words, it would be a neo-colony. If any kind of two-state that has been put forward in the past would amount to that. But again, I want to emphasize that for those of us inside the United States, far away, we do not pretend to tell the Palestinians what the outcome of their struggle should be.
Okay. And Khaled, one last question. Given the circumstances, what, in your opinion, is the best approach for the Palestinians to adopt?
Palestinians are actually realizing that the so-called peace process path have failed. The last 30 years have been really miserable for Palestinians because they saw that Israel have engaged in a so-called peace process, and at the same time they were committing their crimes on a, you know, business as usual, confiscating Palestinian lands, saying Palestinians have no right to return to their homes, and they're using this whole scheme of peace process to actually slaughter and end and liquidate the Palestinian people right. And now more and more Palestinians are realizing that an alternative revolutionary path is due, and that Palestinians are engaged in this path, and that is the path of liberation and return. And this would also be the bridge of a secular democratic Palestine where everyone can enjoy equal rights, but under the sovereignty of the Palestinian people.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and input. Richard Becker in San Francisco, Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. And thank you. I'll see you next time.